But tonight's performance indulges me. And imagine we are in Q's home. It's a tiny bedsit which is crowded, grimy, full of books and dusty memories. It's here that I found Q. Or rather, when the words found me. My reason for coming here was simple. I came here to see the dirt and write some dirt about the dirt. So tonight, I climb these seemingly endless stairs to the top of this long, lean tenement block. I went in. The room did not leave me wanting. The place was filthy. And the words were waiting. Waiting to be heard. And even though the speaker of those words has long since exited, the words haven't. Here in this tiny room, they still tell the story of a great pearly queen who lived a life as epic as any tale spun by Homer. A man born of woman who became infamous. Ladies and gentlemen, the words of Quentin Crisp.
I got a lot, of what I got. If you're feeling blue, come up and sing me sometime. I got a flat where you can hang your hat. I got a brand new line. Maybe you would like me to explain it all to you. Come up and sing me sometime.
It all began when I was born on Christmas Day 1908. You know, back when dinosaurs ruled the Earth. This was the same year that the largest meteorite ever to strike the Earth hit Siberia. It missed its mark, for I was born in Surrey. In comparison, the dinosaurs did not fare so well. Though this small piece of celestial luck ran out as soon as I stepped out of my mother's womb onto dry land. It was then I realized that I had made a terrible mistake. You can imagine what my life was like when I tell you that I had wanted my book to be called My Reign in Hell. This was rejected by the publishers, and The Naked Civil Servant was used instead. Oh well. At least I have the consolation of knowing that never in the history of the printed word has so much mileage been gotten out of one small flimsy book. Which was merely the story of a man who wore makeup and lived to tell the tale. I know it hardly seems enough, but I grew up in a time when there was so little liberty that if a girl wanted to wear nail varnish, she had to leave home for good. And if a man wore suede shoes, there was nothing for him to do but join the Foreign Legion. So you can imagine the feathers I rustled, parading the streets of London, blind from mascara, dumb with lipstick, and my overcoat wrapped around me like a movie star's cape. Many times, people on the street, without a word, slapped me or spat in my face. Once, as I waited for a bus, a crowd of the curious grew and grew around me until no traffic could pass. Strangely, I was not frightened by the mob. But rather excited. Now, of course, you wonder why. Why draw so much attention to myself? After all, I must have known there would be consequences. Well, part of the truth is that exhibitionism is like a drug, and having been hooked on it in my teens, I was used to taking doses so massive in my 20s that they would have killed a novice. The other part of the truth was that I had no real choice. All my life I knew I was different. Theatrical, Mother had called it. When I spoke, I threw the whole of my body into every word as if it would be my last. Twisting and turning on the little stage of my life for all I was worth. If I had played Macbeth, he would have been in tinsel steeped. Then slowly, over the years, I realized what they were laughing at. And I turned it. I made it my style. I dyed my hair fire truck red, and my old self Dennis Platt took on the plumage of Quentin Crisp. So how did I transform myself into this powdered messiah? Well, I took a journey into the interior, which is not altogether a pleasant excursion, because as well as totting up what you consider to be your assets, you also have to take a long, hard look at what your friends call the trouble with you. And it's the synthesis between these two opposites which will be your identity. But that's not quite enough. You see, it's like your fingerprints. These two are your very own, but if they are discovered, they may be used against you. Therefore, you have to polish up your raw identity until it becomes a lifestyle. Something interesting by which you can do barter with the outside world to get from it what you want. I won't say what you deserve, because if we all got what we deserve, we would starve. Look at me. I've lived most of my life in poverty just beyond redemption. In one room which has never been cleaned in 50 years. This brings me to my first message of hope. Never sweep the floor where you live, because after the first 4 years the dirt doesn't get any worse. It's just a question of not losing a nerve. I'm sure I'm right about this. Just the other day someone said to me, "No wonder you're nice to everybody, you never do any housework." So it would seem that anyone who cleans their house goes off into a blind rage. Worn out, I shouldn't wonder with all that sweeping, dusting, doing the dishes. Now, there's no need to do the dishes unless you've passed the fish barrier. It works like this. When you're hungry and you look at your plate and it says bacon, you think I could eat an egg. And the next day, when the plate says egg, you think, I could eat fish. But when you've eaten the fish, you have to do the dishes. I'm only telling you these things so as to set you free from these boring domestic rituals, so as to give you some time during each day when you stop looking outward and start looking inward, so as to decide who you truly are. You don't have to be more on outrageous than other people. You simply have to be more and more like yourself. Then you have a certitude about what you're doing in your own eyes. And so, of course, if you look into your soul and find that you are ordinary, then ordinary you must be. But if possible, you must be so ordinary that you can imagine someone saying, "Come to my party and bring your humdrum friend." And that means you. It's catching on. A taxi driver asked me what I do for a living. I said, "I am in the profession of being." He answered, "Really? I do a bit of that in my spare time." I thought that was marvellous. I'm very lucky. I meet a lot of interesting people. Though they're not the rich and famous everyone assumes I run around with. No. They're the glorious riffraff of life, just like you. And that brings me to my second message of hope. Never try to keep up with the Joneses. Drag them down to your level. It's cheaper. Now, if we're going to develop your lifestyle, we must banish altogether thoughts which are self-diminishing. You mustn't imagine that anything you discover up here, when you make your journey into the interior, is too trivial or distasteful to the world. The curiosity of the neighbours about you is a tribute to your individuality, and you should encourage it. Never try to hide who you are. In their time, Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton were the movie megastars of my day. At first they brought style to marriage, and then they brought style to divorce. but even they expressed the fear that the paparazzi in Rome would take photographs of them in the bathroom. Now, the way to deal with that problem is not to build a higher and higher wall around your villa, but to learn to urinate with style.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feel, and I'm happy again.
Yes, style. Style like the great actress Tallulah Bankhead had. Now, she dived into hell with an elan which was all her own. She scandalously quipped once that, "My daddy warned me about the dangers of men and alcohol, but he didn't say a word about women and cocaine." She smoked 5 packs of cigarettes a day, swore like a fisherman, drank like a fish, and was promiscuous with men, women, and actors. Theatre-goers went to see her chiefly to marvel that such a debauchee could still speak. I saw her perform on stage in a crime thriller called The Serpent's Tooth. When the curtain went up at the start of the show, we were shown on stage a bloody corpse on the floor of an opulent drawing room. Miss Bankhead entered from an upstage door, and she was supposed to walk in, discover the body downstage, and then scream. The starting gun for the evening's murder mystery, as it were. But that night, as she entered, a huge burst of applause exploded around the theatre. So magnificent was her style that she calmly stepped over the corpse she was about to discover, came down to the footlights, and stood bowing and smiling until the crowd died down, and then said, "Thank you, darlings." After which she stepped back over the corpse and screamed. But of course, before you can have such dazzling style as hers, you must first get your home life absolutely squared away. From now on, you should try to regard your home as your dressing room, and the world will be your stage. At home, there must be nothing which does not represent the kind of person you have decided to become. It's no good dressing like a pig farmer for 30 years while saying, "I was really meant to be a ballet dancer." By that time, pigs will be your style. Now to the other people in your life, in particular, lovers. I never used to speak in public about relationships. I had tried them, they had failed. But doing this show over the years, many, many women in the middle of their lives have always asked me the same question. Is there life after marriage? The answer is no. The constant proximity of another person will cramp your style in the end. Unless that person is somebody you love. And then the burden will become unbearable at once. I can see that I've upset some of you. So, since you've been so nice, I will make one small crispensation for you. I will lean, for tonight, towards true love sufficiently to say that if you are actually stuck with someone, you'd best stagger on with them. It's the very best I can do. Believe me, I too wanted desperately to find the great dark man who would take me away from all this. One contender was a man as big as a barn door and as easily pushed to and fro. The first night I saw him in a cafe, he seemed badly in need of a meal. But as soon as I bought him some supper, he fell asleep on the mound of chips. I took him home with me, and he slept beside me like a rugged angel. The next morning, as he was leaving, I nodded towards his small bundle of possessions and said, "You can leave your things here while you're looking for a room." He said, "Sure."
At last, come along.
3 long years later, they were still there. He visited every weekend, and my life became a series of Saturdays for which I prepared, and Sundays from which I recovered. When presumably to normalize our relationship, he suggested a little sex. I concurred. My friends described me at the time as dedicated. Maybe I was. But if I was, it was because I realized that if he was reaching up to me, he must have come from depths that only Dante could scan. He'd never known a world in which he had the upper hand, so I became his domestic slave. To stretch my meager funds, we ate at home, which meant I was also obliged to cook. This I could only do by racial memory. Before this, my idea of home cuisine was to make toast when the bread had become too green to eat raw. As I lived out my sentence, I found that I had become so neurotic by all this domesticity that I was made weepy by the slightest thing. I would burst into a fit of tears if the kettle was not facing due east. Of course, it takes two to tango, and my barn door swung from hot to cold in his feelings towards me. At his warmest, he would make these grand declarations of affection in front of people. But one Arctic night, he walked behind me and called out every foul word in his limited vocabulary to describe a homosexual. That evening, I realized that I was all he had, and he hated me for it. A few months later, in the middle of a sketchy embrace, he said, "Let's peg it in."
While a cigarette was burning, my heart was burning too. A smoke ring for your finger I fashioned in a blue. While a cigarette was burning, our smoke rings all came true. We tried to make them linger.
Now look what I've done. Like the Titanic, I've found my iceberg. Let's move on. My travels from the edge of obscurity to being an overnight sensation was some 60 years in the making, and it was through television that I finally gained notoriety in the late 1970s. Back then, Harlan Ellison, the science fiction writer, said that television was a glowing glass tit whose milk was a deadly distraction, while Andy Warhol suckled the same nipple and cheerfully informed us that we'd all be famous for 15 minutes. I chose to believe in the latter, and equally applied for my quarter of an hour. My first taste of this was the lovely man called Dennis Mitchell, who wanted to make a documentary about me. I went along with it, which is much of how my life has gone. And so my tiny single room became besieged by cameras, cable, and crew. It was wonderful. And all that was required of me was to talk about myself, something in which I had practiced until I had the stamina of a marathon runner. So, for 2 glorious days, I stood about my dressing room, striking heroic poses as I leaned on the mantelpiece, all the while chirping out my little anecdotes into the growing cloud of dust which had been unsettled by all this traffic. This short footage of my life was shown on Granada Television, and to my delight, someone contacted me about making my life story into a movie. And then it was only 8 long years later before it came true. Though I shouldn't complain, for I ended up with a young John Hurt playing moi, much better than I could play myself. When it was finally broadcast to households all over England, I can vividly remember watching his magical acting as he poured emotion into my life story. I can also remember how his soulful performance was interrupted every 15 minutes by Clement Freud and his dogs, Henry, selling chunky dog food.
He said he wanted this stuff.
New chunky meat gives your dog the meat and other good things he needs, in chunks, the way he likes it.
My first hint that not all that glitters is gold. Now, after Mr. Hurt's television show, I grew very popular with the press, who sought more dirt on the subject. Remember that homosexuality was still a great unknown then. Historians thought it to be Greek in origin. Politicians and church leaders thought it was smaller than socialism, but much more deadly. The only sure fact they all shared was that we only came out at night. So, when I popped my head above the murky waters of British society, it was akin to the Loch Ness Monster dragging itself ashore from the Stygian depths. So after 60 years of relative obscurity, I became the centre of a storm of curiosity. I, who had sought to tell my story to the whole world, one person at a time, was thrust into the role of spokesman for the whole homosexual community. I won't say gay, because that was a term still making its way into the world. The majority of people still thought gay was a posh word for being happy. We were, to the general public, still mere queers, pufters and benders. The kindest words in the lexicon for us were sporty girls or artistic boys. On these interview shows, I was introduced as a homosexual, the word always spoken as if it were a malady, an illness. It made them feel better to cast us as something which should be cured. And I was quite happy to play the part of the victim. Remember, an actress in her early career always plays anything she can get. Anyway, in truth, all my life I had felt that my homosexuality was a curse, and now simply said so on camera. My on-air conversations were to draw sympathy from some, disgust from others, and white-hot anger from those who you might have thought were my allies. When my autobiography was reprinted, Gay News said that the book should have been published posthumously. This I took as a polite way of telling me to drop dead. Once more I was out of step with my own kind. Back in my youth, the police used to roam the streets in packs searching for buggers to beat. Of course, I was easily spotted with my flamboyant makeup, and found myself banned from the few gay pubs there were. I was considered too much of a risk. My own kind thought that I was deliberately spoiling it for them. Now, some 40 years later, I found myself and my makeup once again spoiling it for this new generation. I was cast by them into the role of a self-loathing, bitter old queen who should hurry up and die. I, who had stood up before any of them was born. How dare they? They had not walked in my shoes. Back then there were no role models to show me the way. Just the daily confirmation from other human beings with their stares and insults that I was not one of them, that I did not belong. My response to this anger from my own kind was to do what I have always done. I maintained my style. I did not engage in confrontation, but instead began my one-man show in a pub called The Wonky Donkey. My first audiences were so small that they did not even add up to what you would call a thin crowd. They were more like clumps of ones, twos and threes in the dark. Most had just wandered in by accident and found themselves in my parlour. Through these shows, I began to develop my material, and audiences slowly increased, selling out the Duke of York Theatre in London 1978. I was at my pinnacle, and I had been asked to perform my one-man show in the Big Apple.
New York, New York! It's a wonderful... Now, to get there meant I had to lose my virginity and get on a plane for the first time. I found it less exciting than the movies had led me to expect. Nobody became hysterical, no one near me was handcuffed, and I couldn't glance nervously at the ice forming on the wings, because I couldn't see them. Flying. You eat, you sleep, you go to the movies, and you go to the bathroom. You're hardly better off than on Earth. But at least you get off somewhere else from where you started. My agent had found me a room at the Hotel Chelsea, and I immediately felt at home with the rest of the artistic riffraff. During my brief stay there, there was a fire, a robbery, and the death of Nancy by Sid Vicious. And all this excitement thrilled and encouraged me to move to New York, where I lived happily ever after for 22 years until I died. Death, as you can see, has done little to quiet me or the words which I spoke so constantly. It was with these words that I gave my life some shades of meaning, for I think we discover what we truly believe by speaking to someone else. And believe me, I know the truth very well. We are great friends. I don't give away her secrets. She doesn't contradict mine. Now the words are winding down. My story is almost done. There's just enough time for me to deal with my death. So if you have tears, prepare to shed them now. How do you die with style? Well, you must have a way of ending it on your own terms, an exit. Otherwise, you'll be left lying on a bed with people standing around saying, "He can't last much longer." My own was simple enough. I chose at the age of 91, in bad health, to fly and do a tour of my show in England. My close friends warned me against it, saying that I wouldn't survive the long flight. They were wrong. I died some hours later, alone in the guest room of a lovely woman who was putting me up. I smiled in death to see that the gods had not lost their sense of humour, for the policeman who came to answer the emergency call was called PC Sissy. For me, life was a funny thing that happened on the way to the grave. I lived my life as best I could and followed the only path available to me, which was my own. I was neither good nor bad, just completely myself, and told my tale as truthfully as I saw it. Anyway, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Now, my last words are for those of you who seem to feel that the band is always playing on some other street and you cannot get to the party. My message is that the closet door is not locked. And please don't tell me you haven't got a thing to wear, because right in front of me I see such wonderful people, and all you have to do is wear yourselves completely. For that is your style.
I don't drink coffee, I take tea, my dear. I like my toast on one side. But you can hear it in my accent when I talk. I'm an Englishman in New York. You see me walking down Fifth Avenue, walking cane here at my side. I'm an Englishman in New York. Whoa!